Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In his new book, The British Are Coming, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Rick Atkinson tells the story of the early years of the Revolutionary War. It's the first of what he's calling the Revolution Trilogy. It covers the early days of the war from 1775 to 1777. In the book, Atkinson goes to great detail to comb archival papers, letters, and other historical artifacts to create a definitive story so detailed that it reads like Atkinson was there putting pen to paper as he rode horseback with Paul Revere, or marched with General Washington through Long Island, or manned the boats with Benedict Arnold on Lake Champlain. It's a riveting read on how outmanned and undertrained American forces fought for our independence and ultimately turned back the Redcoats. Rick Atkinson is the author of The Guns at Last Light and the Liberation Trilogy, which told the story of World War II. He's also the former writer and editor at the Washington Post, author and historian Rick Atkinson. Welcome to Extension 720.
Thanks, Justin. Good to be here.
And you're also a regular here on Extension 720. You were on with Milt a couple of times.
I was, yeah, back in the day, and it was great fun.
This is such a great book. I have to say that, you know, even before this interview, talking to you, giving you praise for the work that you've put together, this was quite an undertaking. Why do this in trilogy form?
Yeah, and why do the revolution? Well, when I was finishing my trilogy on the American role in the liberation of Europe in World War II, the third and final book came out in 2013, and I'm thinking about what I'm going to do at that point. And the obvious thing would have been to pivot to the Pacific and do for that theater what I'd done for the Mediterranean and Western European theaters. I just didn't have the heart for it, partly because I would have had to start the war over again at Pearl Harbor or even sooner. So, you know, I began casting about what is it you want to do? I can do what I want to do at this point in my career. And this tale has just had its hooks in me since I was a kid. And it tells us who we are, where we came from, what our forebears believed, and the most profound question any people can ask themselves, what they're willing to die for. So, you know, I took it on, and as for a trilogy, I don't think that every narrative needs to be necessarily in three huge right. parts, but looking at the story and trying to understand how it cleaves narratively, it just seemed to me that it breaks in three. And this first volume ends with the Battle of Princeton. Things are looking very dark for the Americans, and Washington in particular. And then he resuscitates their hopes with this dramatic crossing of the Delaware, and off we go.
You know, the book, like I said, it's so vivid and it's so detailed. And a lot of it is move by move, strategy by strategy when it comes to the battles that we see from 1775 to 1777. How do you put that together? What is the process? I mean, where are you crisscrossing the country, finding different papers and pen? Because for World War II, you can watch archival footage. You can look at photographs. There are living representations of that war. How do you research this book, a book that's about our history 200 plus years ago?
Yeah, it's quite different from World War II, as you correctly discern. Well, not only do I crisscross the country, I leave the country. So, for example, Queen Elizabeth II owns the papers of our last king, George III. And she decided in 2016 to open them up for the first time to scholars. And I was one of the first allowed in to look at them. So for a month at Windsor Castle, which is where the papers are kept, every morning I would show my badge at the Henry VIII gate and then again at the Norman Tower. And I'd climb 102 stone steps and 21 wooden stairs to the garret of the Round Tower, begun by William the Conqueror in the 11th century. And that's where the papers are kept. And George, until late in life when he began to go blind, was his own secretary. So he wrote everything by hand. He wrote the copies by hand. It's very tactile. You really feel like you're in his presence. He's a great list maker. His private correspondence is really interesting. His letters to his kids. He's got 15 kids. Correspondence with the Queen, Charlotte, an obscure, drab German princess he married 6 hours after meeting her. And so when you burrow into things like that, you really feel like you're breaking new ground, which I think I did there. And then there are plenty of other archives, the Massachusetts Historical Society, the New York Historical Society. Ann Arbor has the largest collection of 18th century stuff in America, including the papers of a number of British generals. So if you're an archive rat, as I am, you can break ground. And like all great events and personalities in American history, it's bottomless. There's more to discover. There's more to write about. People will be writing about Abraham Lincoln for 500 500 years from now. And I think the revolution is the same.
Yeah, and it is interesting, when, especially with George III, you're talking about him doing the list of generals and almost being a strategist himself, wanting to be there or giving, painting the picture that he feels like he has a big role in this as a tactician, as a strategist.
That's true, and he's driving the train. You know, when the revolution began in April 1775, Americans wanted to believe that he was really a bystander and that he was above the fray and that he was not really directing the war, at least in big strategic terms. And that's not true. He is a war hawk of the first order. And what we can see is that the war goes on for 8 long, hard years across 3,000 miles of open ocean at great cost in blood and treasure to the British Empire, in part because George is determined that it's just going to be that way. And, you know, he's a fascinating character. He's not the foolish reactionary mincing across the stage in Hamilton every night. He's not that kind of guy. He's much more nuanced. He's much smarter. He's much more of an imperial thinker. And of course, this empire he wants to preserve is brand new. It has come about in 1763 mm-hmm. as a consequence of a British victory in the Seven Years' War, what we call the French and Indian War. And he is just determined that that empire, which they have won from the French and the Spanish, is not going to slip away. And he's persuaded that if the American colonies go, it's the beginning of the end.
And it's his time. This is George III's time. This is his war, and this is his legacy, if you will.
It's certainly true. He sees it as critical to the future of his people. We, of course, are a small part of those people, but he's running a mercantile empire. And by that I mean colonies are made to provide raw materials to the mother country and then to buy the finished products that they're making from those raw materials. Right. It's transactional. And he looks at the empire in transactional terms. He doesn't have any particular affection for Americans. In his whole life, he's king for 60 years. He never leaves England. He never even goes to Scotland. So he doesn't know America. And his ministers don't know America. None of them have ever been to the 13 colonies. And so there's a dialogue in which they're speaking past each other.
And there's a great moment, because there seems to be unrest, and of course among the American colonies, of being treated like subjects without any thought to how they live in America. But there's this feeling that King George, there's a little bit of ego involved, that he wants to make sure that the colonies stay in line, that as your book goes on, you recognize even the Declaration of Independence, all the things that go along with that. They're almost in spite of what he sees as the vision for the colonies, and he won't let it be any other way.
Well, that's true, and there's more than a little bit of ego. He sees himself as John Bull, this mythical embodiment of Britain. And when you take that approach to yourself and to your relationship with your subjects, it's hard to find common ground. It's hard to find compromise. And so, you know, what you see when the shooting starts on April 19th, 1775, with Lexington conquered, the British retreat to Boston, by that point, it's very hard to imagine that there's going to be a peaceful solution to this. And after that point, when blood is shed and the wolf has risen in the gorge, and there's a great deal of resentment all around because your friends are dying, the British are oppressive. And then you know, when the Declaration of Independence comes around in July 1776, then it's too late. It's not going to end in any way other than a resolution on the battlefield.
Rick Atkinson is the Pulitzer Prize winning author and historian. The book is The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. It's volume one of the Revolution Trilogy. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation here with Rick Atkinson. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest, Rick Atkinson, he is the author and historian, the author of The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. It's volume one of the Revolution Trilogy. Atkinson, a Pulitzer Prize winner. You know, this book goes into, it takes on a lot of the things that we were taught about the Revolutionary War, the stories of George Washington, the stories of Benedict Arnold, this great story about this story of Bunker Hill, Paul Revere, Concord, Lexington, and even the Boston Tea Party. It goes into all these things that we were taught almost in this kind of blanket way. and this is the way the narrative plays out, and this is how you should know it, and move on to the next subject. That's how we've been taught as Americans.
Yeah.
Starting with the Boston Tea Party, I was not familiar with the lead up to what caused it. I know taxation without representation. I know everything about, you know, really sticking it to the British, if you will, at the, in the Boston Harbor. Mm-hmm. But this was really about a decision that was made by King George that was a business decision more than any sort of tyrannical approach to the colonies.
Yeah, that's true, Justin. They, you know, after the French and Spanish had been defeated in 1763, the terms of the treaty gave Britain a vast territory around the globe, Canada, a billion fertile acres in America west of the Appalachians, some valuable sugar islands, India. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, the empire, this new empire, was deeply in debt. The war had cost them a lot of money, and they're looking to recoup some of that money. And it occurs to them, look, we've helped the Americans. We protected them from the French and the Indians during the war. We fought together. Let's ask them to pay a little bit. Not a lot, a little bit. And it was a little bit, actually, compared to what British taxpayers were paying. And after 150 years of being left alone, Americans just resented that. And they resented the fact they had no voice in deciding what a little bit would be or whether there would be any bit. Right. And so taxes were imposed, the Stamp Act, and there were various measures. And we rebelled against those measures, and they were repealed. We put pressure on Britain by refusing to buy British goods and so on. The king left in place, as a token of Parliament's authority, a small tax on tea. It was really just pennies, literally pennies. And the rebels in New England just said, no, we're not going to pay it. And we're not going to drink tea. And you ship tea over here, and we're going to throw it in the drink. Which
And it was one kind of tea. That was a big part of it, too, from the East Indian Trading Company.
Yes.
Which needed help being propped up. And that was a big part of,
yeah, that's right.
Let's give it to the Americans. They'll prop up our economy.
Yeah. And they thought they were too clever by half. The trading company was bankrupt, or was on the verge of teetering on bankruptcy. It was a huge part of the British economy. And so they decided, well, if we can sell this stuff to the Americans and we can eliminate the middlemen and we can stick this small tax on it and we'll make it cheaper than smuggled tea, which is where Americans were getting most of their tea. So ships show up in Boston Harbor, one ship in particular with more than 300 chests of tea. It's a lot of tea. It's worth a lot of money. And Americans, as usual, were very well informed about what was going down. And famously, some of them dressed as Indians and went down and peaceably, in the sense that nobody was hurt. They broke into the hold of the ship and tossed the stuff into Boston Harbor. And that so enraged the British government, the king in particular. He talked about how hurt he was and how blows must decide. Eventually, he gets to that point. Blows must decide. And so that is a critical turning point in the relationship. That's 1770. So it's 5 years. I mean, 1770 is the Boston Massacre. Then 1773 is the Tea Party. And then you got two more years of trying to find a solution. Benjamin Franklin is still in London at this time looking for some kind of political solution. And it just doesn't happen. And then war begins in April 75.
And you think about the stories of the Boston Tea Party, but you also think of Paul Revere and the British are coming, the British are coming. When you look into these stories and the stories that are really almost become true fables, if you will, in our country and in our culture, are they accurate? When you have the Paul Revere ride to Concord and Lexington, when you have Benedict Arnold and what he's doing in Lake Champlain, when you as a historian go in and you go deeper into some of these stories, do they hold up?
As usual, sometimes yes, sometimes no. Paul Revere never said the British are coming, because he would have been saying that to British citizens. It would have been confusing.
Right.
We were British.
Right.
What he probably said, and what it's been recorded that he said, was the regulars are coming out, the regulars meaning the regular army, regular troops. I use the title, The British Are Coming, because that's really what the book is about.
Yeah.
The British are coming, 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 sending a good part of this ferocious army. They have by far and away the greatest fleet the world has ever seen. Almost half of it will be here in American waters. So the British are coming, and it's not good. The British are coming to burn your homes, to rape your women in some cases. It's a very, very brutal counterinsurgency effort.
That's a part that I took from this book as well, that as we talk about the American Revolution, it's a little bit more with the, you know, you get the images of drums and flutes and this was a savage war. There was this barbaric in the way that some of the scenes in this book about the injuries and the wounds and the dead and the piling up and how the disease and everything that goes into it. This is not a poster fair, if you will.
Yeah, that's certainly true, Justin. I mean, first of all, you got 100,000 smallpox deaths in North America from 1775 to 1782. The King of Terrors, it was called, just a terrible wasting disease. It did horrible things to victims. You have 18th century medicine, which hardly deserves the name. So a man 5'8" tall has 2,500 square inches of exposed surface, 1,000 of that exposed to gunfire in a short-range frontal encounter with the enemy. If he's shot in the torso, the odds are more than 50% that he will die. That medicine is that bad. A lot of killing with the bayonet because muskets are so inaccurate. 50 yards, you might hit what you're aiming at, sort of. Beyond 100 yards, it's hopeless. And so they would close and kill with the bayonet, which is a really terrible kind of face-to-face encounter.
There's a great passage where when the British leave Boston and they get on the ships to inevitably go to New York, which is the big Battle of New York. But when they leave, the first wave of Continental troops to come in are all smallpox survivors.
Yeah.
Washington makes sure that they're pockmarked to show the scars of smallpox because they're afraid this could be weaponized.
Exactly right. They're afraid of what we would call biological warfare. Washington had had smallpox. Once you've had it, you're immune to it. Soldiers who were immune to it were highly prized, partly because they're survivors. And there was concern that the British had done this in the French and Indian War to the Indians, that the British would leave behind blankets infected with smallpox or something like that. And so Washington made certain that the first troops to go into Boston to check it out when the British evacuated in March of 1776, all were smallpox survivors just for that reason. It's also important to remember this is a civil war. This is a civil war that really foreshadows the civil war of the 19th century. You can figure that somewhere between 18 and 20% of white Americans, that's 2 million people in the 13 colonies, plus 500,000 black slaves, but say 20% of those 2 million people are loyal to the crown, loyal most of the time. And so the civil war that begins in 1775 is awful. The rebels treat the loyalists terribly. If you're a loyalist, you are subject to having your property expropriated.
Tory was a nasty word.
Tory was a real slur.
Yeah.
And you could be thrown in jail. There were loyalists who were put on scows in the Hudson River in terrible conditions. Some of them were lowered by windlass 70 feet below ground into an old Connecticut copper mine in rock-walled cells underground known simply as hell. That gives you some idea of what it was like American against American.
Yeah. And also to paint the picture as well that it was just the British soldiers that were raping and pillaging. In this book, you give an objective look that the American soldiers, the militia and also the Continental Army were doing a lot of the same things. They were coming in, they were looking for loyalists, but they also were, there's instances where they're stealing from the townspeople, they're stealing from each other, they're robbing, they're doing everything they possibly can because it's a dire situation.
It is, and they're very undisciplined in many cases. Discipline is the soul of an army, Washington had said early in his career as a soldier in the French and Indian War. And there's very little soul to this army. It's really very undisciplined. It's part of Washington's task is to find the officers and the non-commissioned officers who can impose discipline. And it's two steps backward for every step forward. Part of the time, there's a lot of looting that goes on, pillaging, sort of indiscriminate violence. It's not a pretty sight.
Let's do this. Let's take a break for the news. We come back, let's talk about George Washington, because a tremendous biography, if you will, of him and who he was and what kind of war he was was actually, what kind of strategy he was employing when it comes to the Revolutionary. Rick Atkinson is my guest. He's the author of The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. It's volume one of the Revolution trilogy. Rick Atkinson, the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. We'll continue the conversation here on Extension 720, so stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest, Rick Atkinson. He's the Pulitzer Prize winning author and historian of the book The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777, volume one of the Revolution trilogy. I promise we'd talk about George Washington. I want to do that. An amazing strategy, and one that I think is familiar, and it grabbed my attention, this idea that it wasn't necessarily about winning the war. It was about trying to engage a larger enemy into a protracted, long engagement, one that they would power from, or that they would get sick of at a certain point.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, Washington is just, I was privileged to live metaphorically with Dwight Eisenhower for 15 years in writing the Liberation Trilogy, and my admiration for him only grew over those 15 years. Washington is similar in the sense that, first of all, he's really an admirable person. He's the kind of leader with traits we should demand of all of our leaders. As a general, like Eisenhower, he's not particularly a good tactician. He makes a lot of mistakes. He doesn't see a lot of mistakes. He nearly loses the war by chin whiskers several times. He doesn't see the battlefield spatially and temporally the way a great captain like Napoleon does. And it's going to take him a while to figure that out. Now, when he becomes commander-in-chief in July 1775, he hasn't been in uniform in 16 years.
He was a British lieutenant or
he was
general?
He was a colonel, but he was a militia colonel, Virginia militia, under British command.
Got it.
So he'd learned a lot then, but you know, he's basically a provincial who hasn't been commanding troops in a long time. And even then on a small scale. Now he's got a continental force. He knows very little about artillery, about cavalry, about providing for a continental force, about logistics for a continental force. So he's learning this on the fly. He's learning how to be a political general. His political masters, Congress in particular, there's no rule that says he's got to be subservient to civilian leadership. He's kind of making it up as he goes along. It's one of the great legacies that he left us. Mm-hmm. So he's very aggressive. He's just inherently aggressive, and he wants to mix it up, and he believes he's got kind of a Continental Army approach to things where he wants to go toe-to-toe with the Brits. Realizing, A, he's got very little gunpowder in 1775, and it's hard to slug it out at that point. B, that the British are extremely well trained.
I was going to say, his army was not.
It was not, and he's going up against one of the great professional armies in the world.
There's a tremendous scene in the book where it seems like all hell's breaking loose, and he's more interested in lashing soldiers or getting them in line than dealing with just a mile out as the British redcoats coming to him. Like, just feels like he's got two battles to fight, which is, you know, discipline and how to be a soldier and winning a war.
It's true. There's a scene where he's been pushed off of Long Island. He, again, nearly loses his army. He slips away in the fog across the East River with his army after losing badly the biggest battle of the war. And then the British, September 1776, they land at Kipps Bay on the East River, Manhattan Island. The Americans rally down there, and they immediately are routed, and they begin running away. And he arrives on his horse, and he's so distraught over what he sees, which is his army running away, that he loses control of himself for a bit. And there are several accounts in which he is lashing at men and cursing and trying to drive them back into their positions without any success. The British are not a mile away. They're probably less than 100 yards away. You know, the bullets are flying all around. It's another example where he's leading a charmed life. He goes for 8 years without getting sick, without getting shot. He had seen, you know, his commander, when he was back as a young officer in Braddock's catastrophe near current-day Pittsburgh, Braddock was killed. Washington had 4 bullets through his uniform coat, bullets in the saddle. there's a tincture of indestructibility and invulnerability to him.
And you're absolutely right, because there are a lot of American generals, names like Greene and Benedict Arnold,
yep,
who do see injury, who do see disease, who are half the time in some sort of sick bed, not being able to fight.
That's right.
You're right that he does leave a charmed life in the way that most of the people at that time were affected by war in some way or another.
That's true. He's really robust in health, and I think it's a secret to his success, one of the secrets. You're right. Benedict Arnold is probably the best tactical leader on either side the first couple of years of the war. He's a man born to lead other men in the dark of night. He's really an extraordinary combat leader. Not only on land, he leads 900 men through the Maine wilderness in the late fall of 1775 to appear at the gates of Quebec when we're trying to make Canada the 14th colony. He's shot in the knee during that failed assault. The American commander, Montgomery, is killed. And then he's wounded again at Saratoga. He has a horse fall on him. So he does, you know, but through all of this, what we see in Arnold is somebody who can really fight. Arnold is somebody that George Washington really appreciates.
I was going to ask about that relationship because, you know, obviously there's a little foreshadowing in here because of what we know of Benedict Arnold.
Yeah.
Is that he's a traitor.
Yep.
And in your book, we don't get to that point. You know, like we see the general who does his job, outmanned and outgunned on Lake Champlain, fighting a Royal Navy that should destroy them.
Yes.
And he wins out and he escapes. But everything about him, but what you also see is a reports coming back and letters that he's a hothead, that his men don't necessarily like him, that there's something about him that is almost the antithesis of George Washington.
Yeah, there's something about him. That's right. And you put your finger on it. He is a hothead. He doesn't suffer fools gladly. Not only is he a fine combat leader on land, as you say, when the British are coming down Lake Champlain and they're going to threaten New York, this is in the fall of 1776, who do they turn to build and fight the fleet? Arnold, because as a merchant in Connecticut, he's had a small squadron and he knows how to build ships and how to sail them.
Mm-hmm.
And he does magnificently. He loses his squadron, but he delays the British advance.
He did the job, right?
He did the job. He has the knack for earning the admiration of his superiors, who almost to a man recognize him for what he is. But the enmity, the envy, the dislike of his subordinates, the men who write under him, particularly officers, they're always nattering at him.
There's the court-martial scene in one of the houses where he's there to court-martial somebody else, and they all turn on him, and he's like, how dare you? And he walks out like it doesn't appeal to him.
That's right. They issue an arrest warrant for him, and General Gates, who is his superior, this is in the time of the Lake Champlain-Valcour Island battle. Gates writes to Washington, says, you know, I should probably let the arrest go through, but he's too valuable. I can't afford it. So he quashes the arrest warrant. He's like that. And we can see this festering resentment. Men who are inferior to him are promoted over him. He believes that Congress doesn't fully appreciate what he's been through, the wounds that he sustains, the losses that he sustained as a merchant. So grievances are beginning to accumulate. And of course, in 1780, they will come out full force when he switches sides.
Rick Atkinson is the Pulitzer Prize winning author of The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. It's volume one of the Revolution trilogy. We didn't talk about the Declaration of Independence, which really is what kicks off the reason for this war, really stirs men's souls. But we'll have plenty of time to talk about that when you come back and continue the conversation with the trilogy.
I'd like
thanks
to
for
do
being
it.
Here. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Justin. I really appreciate it.